hardball hitting with a baseball bat. Kick up your heels, kid, and leave them all flat. What does it mean to be American?
Welcome to Eastern Standard and Episode 10 of our special series Democracy Optimists with Joshua Douglas, an election law and voting rights research professor at the University of Kentucky. Democracy Optimist is produced by Dynamics Productions, the Eastern Standard team, and WEKU. Here's Josh Douglas.
Welcome to Democracy Optimist, where we bring you the good, the bad, and the ugly on voting rights and election law with a dose of hope sprinkled in. Every election day, I am focused on numerous races around the country, including various local elections. How do I keep track? Through an indispensable resource called What's on the Ballot. That cheat sheet of elections everywhere is the brainchild of Daniel Nechanian, a reporter and the founder of Bolt magazine. Bolt covers the nuts and bolts of power and political change with a bottom-up approach, focusing primarily on state and local issues that shape public policy, but are largely overlooked by the national media. Daniel, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
It's really fun to join you. Thanks for having me.
So I love the What's on the Ballot cheat sheet. You've been doing this for several election cycles now. I think it started, in 2018? Tell us how it all started.
At the end of the day, I really love elections. I love following elections, I love understanding what is happening around the country and just the nitty-gritty of going in weeds in different places. And, for a while, you're right that this started in 2018. And for a while, I had actually left being a reporter. I stopped journalism and I had gone into doing a PhD. And I was still trying to track elections around the country. And I had created my own spreadsheet, on an Excel sheet or a Google Sheet to try and see what's going on around the country for really my own sake, because there's so much happening, and I'm sure we'll go into that. And now at some point, I started to share that on Twitter, on social media. I cleaned it up a little, but I think in 2018, or I think maybe even 2017, it was still a very informal spreadsheet that then grew and grew. And then when I created Bolts, already a couple of years ago, which really does a number of other things as well, it was essential for me to bring that into the project to be able to have even more capacity and resources to clean this up and make this a product for a lot of people to use. But, at the bottom, it's the product of an election geek who really wants to have tools to be able to follow this and share it with other people.
Yeah, and it's great. And so people can go to boltmag.org and find the What's on the Ballot cheat sheet that you can track, the elections. And again, it has the national races, but it has, really local things, county prosecutor, a ballot initiative in, some place in Pennsylvania that the local voters are deciding some aspect of local law. So how do you decide what to include and how do you actually keep track of it all?
Right. That's exactly right. A lot of most of what's on a sheet at any given moment is local elections, DA races, judges, sheriffs, a bond measure, school board race. And I think what's really the core of the approach here is that there isn't some kind of huge qualitative break between, a federal election and a local election for how I think about things. Of course, the contexts are different. The power is different. The way in which issues are discussed is very productively different. But at the end of the day, the same reason why people get so engaged and interested by what's happening in Congress, what's happening in Washington, D.C., what's happening in the U.S. House race where they live, the reasons why they care, the issues that make them care, or some of the same reasons, some of the same issues for which you should be looking, at what's happening with an affordable housing bond measure in the county next door, or a DA race somewhere in your state, or the election law you were just describing in Pennsylvania. And there's a continuum there. And I think what's really exciting and what's really evolved through the project of What's on the Ballot is how we really create a tool for people to really see it all in one place. You know, they might know already where to follow the race for the U.S. Senate because they can go, you know, to Politico and whatnot. But if they also, for the same reasons, want to follow what's happening locally, you know, this is a one-stop shop where they can get a lot of things. And inversely, you know, a lot of people might not exactly have a full understanding of why they should care about these local races. But if you get them in by showing them the battle for Congress or the battle for the presidency, and that next to that, there's information about these other races that they might start having this like deeper sense of what to follow.
Yeah. And the other thing that's interesting about the What's on the Ballot cheat sheet is that the state and local initiatives are categorized, right? So if you're interested in criminal justice, you can see the various issues, both statewide and local, and all, you can see the trends. You know, I'm, as you know, very interested in democracy and elections and voting rights. And so I always go directly to the voting rights initiatives to see, okay, you know, what cities are voting on ranked choice voting, or, you know, are there places looking at lowering the voting age to 16, or trying to impose some sort of public financing for local campaigns? And they're all in one place, which I think is really helpful. And as you know, I've used the resource a lot in my own writing to help, you know, kind of gather thoughts about what's on the ballot with respect to democracy issues. So you founded Bolts magazine in February 2022 with the express mission of focusing on state and local issues across the country. Why is that approach so critical? You know, there's so much discussion, as you said, of the presidential election or maybe control of Congress. And you obviously talk about that stuff, but you also focus on, you know, state courts and local initiatives. You have a story recently about how one county clerk in Pennsylvania is using an ice cream truck model to try to help voter registration, where they're, you know, basically driving voter registration trucks around the county like you might have an ice cream truck. So why do you have that kind of approach for Bolts?
That's a great question, and it gets exactly to what you were just saying about how you use our cheat sheet as well when it comes to our broader approach at Bolts. So on voting rights and criminal justice, those are two issues where local and state governments have so much authority and so much discretion about what's happening. If you care about these issues, of course the federal government isn't unimportant and federal courts aren't unimportant, but you're really missing so much of the story if we don't have an eye on state and local governments. And that's where a lot of the action matters. But that's where the challenge is as well. There are 3,000 counties around the nation. Obviously, there are 50 states and DC, and then within that, municipalities can have their own authorities as well. And that creates a lot of difficulty for following these issues. It creates effectively the very high barrier of entry for people who care about these issues or could care about these issues to understand what is going on, to engage their own local institutions, to learn from what's happening in another place than where they are. Even if they're reading their own local papers, they might not have a sense of what's happening around the country that may be relevant to what their own local officials are or aren't doing. And that's why I think it's very important. That's where Bolts comes from. You know, it's a tool really to, in various ways, lower the barrier of entry for people to understand, engage their state and local governments on these very important issues. So again, to learn about the important conflicts, development policies happening at the local level around the country, to learn from it, to to unlearn from it if it's something that is going wrong. And also for the media, for journalists, you know, it's also a platform. It's always exciting when a journalist or a media source is using our resources, using our articles to learn about what's happening elsewhere, to enrich their own way of storytelling.
So Bolt's in many ways, I think, trying to fill the gap of many local news organizations, you know, where you've seen local newsrooms close or consolidate or just don't have the resources to focus on issues of local public policy. Why do you think the traditional news media is lacking on this score? And how is Bolt trying to fill that void?
It's a very important question, especially right now. There's so much news about news being in poor shape, media closing. I think when it comes to local news, you know, it's the first problem is that a lot of places don't have a robust local news ecosystem anymore, and that is itself a problem for information, a problem for democracy. You know, Bolt's isn't an alternative to local news. It's not a competitor to local news. I think it's best thought of, or we think of it as a collaborative tool at best. And, you know, I think the first purpose is to plug holes in places where there is a news desert and something important is happening on our very specific set of issues that Bolt's covers, right? So in a way, I'm much more excited to get the chance, as we did last year, for instance, to cover a DA race in rural Pennsylvania, which was a very interesting DA race in rural Pennsylvania, hours from Philly, where a police shooting had really become a defining issue. And that is more exciting than covering a DA race in Philly, maybe, or New York, because of the opportunity to explain something, cover differences that may not exist elsewhere just because there's local media. But also, more importantly, there is a lot of places that have very robust local media, but we can bring our thematic expertise, our understanding of what's happening in different places to enrich maybe what is going on in terms of the coverage of a specific issue, to bring to bear some developments from one place in the country in covering what's happening somewhere else. For instance, if we know that there's an ice cream truck in Pennsylvania to help voting, that helps us ask questions in California or in Texas about whether or not a similar approach is being used.
Yeah. So, you know, you're focusing on voting rights, as you said, and issues of democracy. You're focusing on criminal justice, which we can touch upon in a minute. And also, we mentioned before, state courts, another undercovered area. You know, one resource I love that Bolt has is this guide to every single state Supreme Court. So you can go and look at, you know, who's on the state Supreme Court and the partisan makeup and just the details. Why is covering state courts so important to you?
And that's such a great example, state courts in particular, of everything we've just been talking about, because state courts, especially in the wake of Dobbs, especially in the wake of the shift of the federal judiciary to the right in a way that makes their decisions a bit more predictable on a lot of issues, state courts have really come into view as institutions that are seeing some of the same fights, some of the same important policy battles around abortion rights, around voting rights, around the death penalty, as we've always been seeing and aware of at the federal level. And yet the attention, the understanding of what's happening in state courts, who has the power on what court to do what, is really lacking. You know, if tomorrow we got a text alert from the New York Times that a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court has chosen to step down, I'm betting that everyone who is right now, who hears this right now, will immediately know what that means, what the implications are, how that will shift the court or not, right? And yet, I also think that nearly everyone who's listening to this, we would have trouble knowing what a retirement or an election or an appointment in their own state court or another state court would mean to issues of abortion rights, issues of voting rights. And that's an important gap that we should try collectively as media to fill, to pay more attention to the importance of state courts, to the appointments, elections, vacancies that are happening there, and what the balance of power is, what are the different clauses in different state constitutions. I mean, you yourself have done some amazing work, right, on trying to pay attention to how a state constitution can ground the claims when it comes to voting rights. But all of that needs more understanding, because a lot of change is happening at the state level.
Yeah, and it's important to recognize how much state court decisions touch people's lives, probably more so than most U.S. Supreme Court decisions. Maybe Dobbs in the abortion right context is an outlier, but most U.S. Supreme Court cases don't have the same kind of impact on everyday lives as many state Supreme Court decisions, and yet we seem to focus so much on the U.S. Supreme Court instead of state court. So it's really great that Bolts is taking on that approach.
And just a quick point to say that in many states, there are elections for state court. Now, we could discuss whether or not that's a good thing, whether people approve it, but it is the case, right? It is the case that in about half the states or more, there are elections. And often people do not pay attention to these. And there's often a lot of strange things that happen in Supreme Court elections, money pours in. So like the people with money understand the importance of these elections. And so it's important that everyone really is paying attention to who sits on these courts.
Yeah. So everything seems so polarized today, and you're focusing on very polarized issues of democracy, of voting rights, of criminal justice. How do you maintain a neutral approach as a nonprofit, nonpartisan news organization?
Yeah, I think what's important is that we both are not covering voting rights as a way to cover politics. It's really the other way around, covering politics as a way of understanding what is going on voting rights, how what innovations, what policies are making it easier or harder to get to this principle that everyone should have a voice in how they are governed. And importantly, if that's your governing question, again, what are the policies, the hurdles to this idea of democracy, the promise of democracy? There is a story to be told everywhere, whether it's a Republican place, a Democratic's place, whether there's innovations that are happening in a blue state or red state, whether there's harm being done to the principle of democracy. Pretty much every state, for instance, other than Maine and Vermont, do not allow some people to vote based on a felony conviction, for instance. In many states, it's much more restrictive. But there is in every state other than Maine, Vermont, some form of organizing right now to try and expand the franchise. And so there are stories to be told there, whether it's in California, a blue state where there is an active effort to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot to allow people to vote from prison, or whether it's a red state like Florida or Virginia, where the law is much more restrictive and voting rights organizers are maybe choosing a more incremental approach to what they would like to change. But those are all struggles that are happening at the same time in different ways. And we can keep an eye on all that, irrespective of whether the individuals in office are on the left or on the right.
So Daniel, you have your pulse on kind of nationwide voting issues as well as at the local level. And it raises the question of why people even should bother voting, right? Especially if you live in a so-called swing state and you think you know how the presidential election is going to come down. What's the point? Why should people vote?
That's a great question for Bolts especially, and for what we're talking about, because we get that so often, that the way in which the presidential election is structured makes the majority of people in the country sort of beyond feel like their vote is unimportant, right? But a lot of these other struggles, these conflicts, these battles of criminal justice and voting rights we're talking about, but also everything else, is happening at the local level, right? A DA primary in Chicago, which is, for instance, happening this year, is going to be extremely important to the size of the jail population in this huge part of the country that in November will not be especially important for the presidential race, to the extent that Illinois is not a swing state for the presidential election, right? If you care about about affordable housing, the city council races in LA are extremely important this year, for instance, in terms of competing visions of housing really going at it. If you care, if you care about the voting rights for people with felony convictions, as we were just talking about, there are stuff happening in Mississippi and Florida that you should be paying attention to. So there's always, there's always organizing activism on the left, on the right, whatever your issue is, or around the country that is trying to change the way in which our lives are structured. And elections are not the be all and all of what's happening there, but it is definitely a place where it's always going to come to a head.
Yeah, that's really an important message that, local elections have such an important impact on people's lives. Daniel Nechanian is a reporter and the founder of Bolt Magazine. Daniel, thank you so much for joining Democracy Optimist.
It's been really great. Thank you.
Josh, you mentioned at the top of the show that every election year you rely on Bolt's What's on the Ballot cheat sheet to track various elections. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, every year this is such a vital resource for me as I'm trying to figure out what elections that I want to be focusing on and which ones to cover. I went back and looked again at the 2023 cheat sheet, and it reminded me that in every election cycle, there are important state and local races that impact democracy. For example, in 2023, Louisiana voters agreed to ban so-called Zuckerbucks, or private donations, to election officials to help run an election. Rockville, Maryland voters rejected a measure to recommend lowering the voting age to 16 for local elections, so it won't follow other Maryland cities that currently let 16 and 17-year-olds vote in their city or school board elections. There were local ballot measures regarding criminal justice in Colorado, and five local jurisdictions voted on election administrators, such as county clerks, which included in Seattle the defeat of an election denier who had ties to conspiracy groups. I probably wouldn't have known much about many of those elections were not for the What's on the Ballot cheat sheet. I'm sure that this year's guide for 2024 will have significant elections beyond the presidential election this year. Connecticut voters, for example, will decide whether to amend their state constitution to allow no-excuse absentee voting. There will be plenty of local measures on the ballot as well.
All right, give us a fun election fact.
To me, some of the most important races that I track using the What's on the Ballot cheat sheet are for elections for Secretary of State, as that individual in most states is in charge of the state's elections. But the Secretary of State is the chief election officer in only 38 states, 31 who are elected and 7 who are appointed, usually by the governor or the legislature. In 10 states, the chief election officer is not the Secretary of State and is appointed typically by the Board of Elections or a state election commission. And 2 states, Alaska and Utah, have their lieutenant governor serve as the chief election officer. Many states have pretty complicated structures. In Kentucky, we have both an elected Secretary of State and an appointed Board of Elections, which jointly oversee Kentucky elections. We also have at the county level the county clerk and a local Board of Elections. The Kentucky Board of Elections, the statewide board, has 8 members, all appointed by the governor, with the requirement that 4 are Republican and 4 are Democrats. The Secretary of State serves on the board as well and can provide a tie-breaking vote. The staff of the Board of Elections is also explicitly bipartisan.
And what's one thing we can do to support democracy?
You could probably see this one coming. Check out Bolt's and subscribe to its weekly newsletter. This free subscription will let you stay up to date on issues of local criminal justice, voting rights, and other important issues. Then share your favorite article with a friend.
Next on Democracy Optimist, veteran Kentucky journalist Al Cross.
People gravitate to information sources that confirm their beliefs, not challenge them. They're looking for confirmation. as much as they are information.
You're listening to Democracy Optimist, a special election year series from Eastern Standard and WEKU.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at WEKU.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top five stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
You're listening to Democracy Optimist, a special election year series from Eastern Standard, WEKU, and Dynamics Productions. Our host, University of Kentucky election law and voting research professor Josh Douglas.
Welcome to Democracy Optimist, where we bring you the good, the bad, and the ugly on voting rights and election law, with a dose of hope sprinkled in. Today we are speaking with decorated Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Al Cross, one of the most significant reporters in Kentucky, particularly in lifting up the voices of rural communities. Al, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Well, thanks. I'm not really a reporter anymore. I'm director emeritus of the Institute for Rural Journalism. But I write a political column, and I think about the intersection of media and politics.
Well, I know that most people in Kentucky who have read your journalism over the years would say that you've never lost that title of decorated journalist either. And to that end, you've covered national Kentucky and local politics for a long time. What's the biggest change you have noticed, specifically when it relates to elections and voting rights, over the years in your observation of those different levels of politics?
Well, in a larger sense, the biggest change we've had in the last half century is the turn of the state to the Republican Party. That began in 1956 with the election of two Republican senators and a Republican president carrying the state. And it was largely completed in 2016. When the Donald Trump landslide brought into office a number of Republicans in the state legislature, who I don't think would otherwise have won. And that's an indication of the latest trend, the nationalization of state politics, especially on the Republican side, where Trump has basically taken over the party and turned it into something of a personality cult. And people identify more with Trump than they do with the Republican Party. In terms of voting rights and elections, I think that Trump has been a very bad actor in that regard in reducing the trust and faith that people should rightly have in the election process.
So you mentioned the nationalization of kind of all politics and the Trumpism that has infected much of our discourse. That's also infected journalism, right? Especially with the collapse of many local newsrooms. How has the collapse of local newsrooms and the consolidation of the media affected democracy?
Well, people are less informed. Local newspapers used to have lots of coverage and commentary about state government and politics, the daily papers would have more about national stuff. Now they're more locally focused, and people just have less information. You know, they're getting their information from sources that are superficial or biased or both.
Yeah, I think this also reflects people's trust in the media. You know, according to a recent Gallup poll, only 32% of Americans have either a great deal or a fair amount of confidence in the media. That number ties the lowest reading, which had been from 2016. Why do you think that is, and how do we fix it?
Well, since 1969, some loud voices in this country, mostly from the right wing, have been accusing journalists and their paymasters of unfairness, political bias, bad motives, and now even outright lying. When the right wing developed its own information sources on talk radio and cable news, those attacks were amplified, and the audiences were ready to believe them. Now, there's also been some criticism from the left about the pro-business bias of corporate-owned media, and that has eroded trust among independents and Democrats. But this is largely a problem coming from the right. I really don't know how we can fix it when the proliferation of media outlets and the fractionalization of the media environment have made every outlet hungry for audience and thus inclined to give readers, listeners, and viewers what they want, not necessarily what they need. People gravitate to information sources that confirm their beliefs, not challenge them. They're looking for confirmation as much as they are information. One thing all legitimate news outlets could do is make clear the separations between fact and opinion and keep repeating to their audiences and their potential audiences on social media the journalistic principles that they aim to follow and invite the audience to hold them accountable to those principles and to suggest topics for coverage.
So what are some of those principles that journalists should follow that media entities and, you know, particularly, you know, areas that reach rural voters?
Well, the fundamental thing about journalism is a search for the truth. And Marty Baron, who was the editor of The Washington Post, liked to say that they presented the most actionable version of the truth. The primary tenet of the Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics is seek truth and report it. That is really what you have to be after. And I think that should tell us that journalism ought to be more about facts than about opinion. And I don't think that is really that much of a problem when it comes to rural journalism, but it is to the national journalism that we see, where everybody wants to stick an opinion in one way or the other. And sometimes opinion, well, opinion's a lot easier to pay for than facts. To find facts and report them takes more money and putting talking heads up and having them debate.
I mean, this reminds me a little bit of one of Trump's press secretaries who said that, you know, she didn't believe in the facts that the reporters were asking about. And she said that, you know, she had alternative facts. So how do we convince people that facts are facts and that there are not alternative facts out there?
Well, I think most people are capable of seeing what the facts are. But when you put them in a partisan or ideological or Trumpist kind of frame, they are less inclined to apply their intellect to it, and they're more inclined to go with their gut. And I really don't know how you overcome that other than just persistently sticking to the facts.
So let's talk a little bit about election integrity and the myth of voter fraud that has seemed to infect a lot of our public discourse. Why do you think that myth that there's massive voter fraud or that the 2020 election was not legitimate, why do you think that is spread so widely among certain populations? And again, you know, I'm always looking for solutions. How would you combat it?
Well, it's almost entirely a creation of Donald Trump. You can see my latest column about that. And I don't know how you fix that problem. Beyond that, people are less inclined than ever to trust people in power, and they don't have a deep working knowledge of the election system. Those of us who are familiar with the election system have a great deal of faith in it. But if we testify to that, people don't necessarily have a great deal of faith in us.
Yeah, and we've also seen an attempt to rewrite recent history, such as, you know, what happened at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, 2021. It reminds me of the book 1984, you know, where the lie becomes the truth if you say it enough times. What do you make of some of the Trump supporters' suggestions that the people who breached the Capitol are themselves hostages or that there was a peaceful protest?
Well, like the Nazis said, tell a big enough lie often enough and millions will believe it. When people have bought into the idea of Donald Trump as savior, they push back really hard on the idea that he's a bad actor. There's just not much persuading those folks.
Yeah, and I guess so the solution is, though, you know, for the majority of Americans to continue to tell the truth, to tell the facts, and to disseminate it as widely as possible. There are facts out there, of course, and we have to continue to educate people about what those facts are.
Yeah, I like to point people to the story that the Associated Press did in late 2020. They looked at every fraud allegation in the six battleground states in the 2020 election, and they found less than 600 votes in those six states that were arguably fraudulent. And it was largely people trying to vote twice, and there was no evidence of rigging the process.
Yeah, and the stories that you see, there's always some anecdotes of people being charged. In 2020, it was almost entirely Donald Trump voters who were caught in some sort of scheme, and, you know, not widespread at all. There are very isolated anecdotes. Also reminds me of a study that a fellow election law professor did that was published in the Washington Post in this discussion of voter fraud at the polls. He looked at every election over the span of 12 years to see how many people were showing up to the polls and pretending they were someone they're not or have some sort of voter fraud issue at the polls. And what he found was there was 31 credible instances out of over a billion ballots cast. And then when you look at that 31, and this was nationwide, most of them were things like a father and son with the same name, the son being Junior, voting in the same precinct because they both lived there and the poll workers checking off the wrong person, something like that. So, again, the facts are there and we just have to continue to disseminate them.
Right.
You know, what do you think is the biggest issue regarding elections in Kentucky? And maybe put a different way, if you could wave a magic wand and change one aspect of the way we vote in Kentucky, what would you wish for?
I would open the polls longer. We're one of the few states that closes polls at 6 p.m. local time, which is a throwback to the days when the huge majority of households had two parents and one income. We now have 3 days of early voting, and that's helpful, but ideally we need a week to accommodate personal and work schedules.
Yeah, and that would bring Kentucky more in line with a lot of other states with respect to the opportunities to cast a ballot. We're also one of the earliest closing times. I think only Indiana also closes at 6. So often in presidential election years, you see the state of Kentucky called for the presidency pretty early when lots of people are voting in lots of other states. And it's interesting to watch the legislative debate. You know, they're talking about repealing the 3 days of early voting. Other people are looking to expand it as well as the poll hours. How do we convince people to get their legislatures to care about this so that they will change election laws in the way that you suggest?
Well, I think legislators do care about election laws. After all, that's how they get elected. And I think they've heard from enough voters that early voting will continue. I think it's popular. And I think Republicans who control the legislature see that it was not harmful to their prospects. I doubt it's going to be expanded because they're just not inclined to do that. But I think we'll keep our early voting. And the drawback to expanding the polling hours is having to pay the poll workers more and have them stay longer. And it's hard to recruit poll workers anyway.
So we hear so much trepidation going into this year's election season. Are you optimistic about voting in elections? And how can we stay optimistic if you know, whether you are or not? How do we stay optimistic during a time when we hear about all of these concerns?
I am optimistic because I have faith in the system. And the lack of any substantial fraud in the last three elections should be persuasive to people who are willing to consider the facts.
Great. I'm optimistic, too, of course. I mean, that's, you know, one reason I called this show Democracy Optimist is that, you know, I think people are hearing so much about America's decline as a democracy and the potential for all of the major issues. You know, we could throw up our hands or we could focus on ways to engage people at the local, state, and national level. What's one thing that you think listeners can do to support civic engagement and democracy?
Well, the big obstacle we have is polarization. So I think it's essential that we respect other people's views and we keep an open mind. Just because somebody is enthralled to one particular politician or ideology does not mean they're a bad person. You can find common ground with almost anyone, and we've got to look for that to help bridge this polarization that we suffer from.
Yeah, and it requires having conversations, you know, with all sorts of people, being open to challenge of your initial beliefs, you know, and listening, as we discussed previously, to the facts, and recognizing that there are facts out there, not alternative facts that you might want to shoehorn into your own preconceived notions.
And here's the hardest thing, recognizing that a lot of people are out to deceive you and that you may have been deceived. That's a hard thing for many people to admit.
Yeah. And what do you do when you recognize that that's occurring, or perhaps when you see, you know, a loved one who's being deceived by, you know, what some politician is peddling? How do you respond to that?
Well, I'd refer them to the AP story about vote fraud in 2020. Because that's sort of the beginning of all this distrust. There have been a number of other stories that people don't necessarily believe the Associated Press. You need to make the point that this is the world's largest and most trusted news gathering organization that's owned by news outlets themselves from all parts of the political spectrum, and they have to be trustworthy and straight in what they do. If you want to trust any media outlet, it's the AP, and that's why I refer people to that story so often.
Yeah, and we'll make sure to put a link to that story on the episode page for this episode. Al Cross, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for joining Democracy Optimist and shedding a light about the importance of journalism to sustaining our democracy.
Glad to be with you, Josh. Good luck.
This is Tom Martin. I'm here with Democracy Optimist host Josh Douglas. And Josh, you're a University of Kentucky election law and voting research professor. And my experience is that most law professors are not keen on talking to the media. Why do you do it?
I think that's right, that sometimes law professors can be shy about engaging the public in their work. You know, there's that, you know, old adage about scholars are just, you know, engaged in navel gazing and just focused on the arcane aspects of their field. But of course, voting in elections is different, right? I mean, this is about the foundation of our government, the foundation of our democracy. It's what got me into the field to begin with, was recognizing how someone's vote, the thing that people fight for and people have died for, is so meaningful to everyday Americans, because it's the way that we collectively decide who leads us and therefore what policies we are all governed under. Of course, I teach at a public university, so that's, I think, part of the public role. But I really, you know, focus. I do a lot of scholarship on things like, you know, how to read state constitutions and how to protect voting under state constitutions, or the history of voter registration laws and how that should inform litigation. So I've done a lot of that work in the scholarly space. But I think if you're not explaining this stuff to the very people who are so intimately impacted, then you're not engaging fully in the power of the role of trying to protect democracy, which is what this really is all about.
Well, tapping into your expertise in election law and voting, what is the election law of the day for this segment?
So we were talking about journalism and the role of journalism and what do reporters do and what do they do on election day? Well, many of them are at the polls, right, watching what is going on and interviewing voters. But all states have laws on what the lawyers call campaign-free zone. That is the area around the polling place where people may not campaign. But interestingly, several courts have struck down laws that impose a campaign-free zone as it pertains to exit polling or reporters interviewing voters. Under the First Amendment, journalists have strong rights to be close to the polls, even closer than those who are campaigning, to conduct exit polling. And the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press has an entire guide online for journalists on the laws involved in covering the voting process. Again, And each state differs in terms of how big the campaign free zone is. Some states it's 50 feet away from the polls. Some states 200 or 300 feet. The U.S. Supreme Court has upheld these campaign free bubbles. But I found it interesting that some courts have said they don't apply to journalists who are engaged in covering the voting process or engaged in exit polling and interviewing voters.
For those conversations that we're getting into in this election season, it's always fun to have a good nugget of information handy. Can you give us a fun election fact?
Journalism as a profession and journalism to cover kind of the leaders of society and government has existed for centuries. There was a Daily Gazette in ancient Rome that served as one of the earliest recorded forms of journalism. This Daily Gazette delivered news and information to the people by posting it in strategic places for literate individuals to read. And so, you know, in society, you would literally go around in ancient Rome and see the posting of this journal, the Acta Diurna, that provided essentially the news of the day. So journalism, like the law, is one of our oldest professions.
Well, Josh, I think it's fair to say that Democracy Optimist is motivated by a concern about the condition and the future of democracy. What one thing can we do to support democracy?
Subscribe to your local newspaper. I believe firmly in the power of local journalism to shed a light on what's going on in city halls all across the country. And, you know, that has such an important impact on people's everyday lives. Local journalism is vital to keeping democracy alive. So if you're able to subscribe to your local paper, please do. I subscribe to my local paper. I'd like to subscribe to many local papers around the country. And of course, that's often not possible. But choose one and throw a few of your dollars to your local paper. And of course, I guess we're on public radio, so I should also say that you should support public radio as well.
And I'll have to say I have a Support Democracy, Subscribe bumper sticker from Al Cross.
Perfect. I should get one of those.
A couple of developments to call to your attention. Kentucky's Republican Secretary of State Michael Adams has received the 2024 Profile in Courage Award from the John F. Kennedy Library and Museum Foundation. Adams was awarded for, quote, expanding voting rights and standing up for free and fair elections despite party opposition and death threats from election deniers, end quote. The award recognizes public servants who have risked their careers by putting the public interest ahead of their own political standing. Secretary Adams was Josh Douglas's guest on the first episode of Democracy Optimist.
So in an era in which partisanship seems to drive everything we talk about with respect to elections and voting rights, you have publicly strived for bipartisanship in the conversation about Kentucky election law. Why do you do that? And is it successful?
Well, it's certainly been successful here. I think it would succeed elsewhere if anybody else would have the good sense to try it. I think really any policy area, you ought to try to get as many voices together as you can. But I think especially with elections, it's really critical because you don't want to sense that one team is writing the rules and the other team is excluded. Because what that leads to is a doubt about the election being fair in the first place, and a sense that people aren't being included. The whole point of elections is to include everybody and have every voice heard.
Kentucky Secretary of State Michael Adams from earlier in this series. That theme of bipartisanship is also evident at the State Board of Elections. Its six members split evenly among Democrats and Republicans. I spoke recently with two members, Republican Deanna Brenger and Democrat Ben Chandler. How, in the polarized atmosphere that we're in right now, are you so often able to come to agreement with a board that's split 50-50 Democrat and Republican compared, let's say, to the FEC, which is 3-3 and often deadlocks? Do we have a secret sauce here in Kentucky?
We went through the pandemic election, and as you know, the pandemic election was almost a complete change in how we do elections. It was very controversial with many people, and yet throughout our effort to put that system together for that particular election, almost every vote that we had on the state board was unanimous. even though we're split right in the middle, Republican and Democrat. I don't know what the secret sauce is, other than I think we've got a number of members on the state board right now who are absolutely determined to make sure that the elections are run properly and that we do it in a bipartisan way. We think that if the two parties can agree on an election system, then people will have more confidence in the outcomes of those elections. And we've gone out of our way to make sure that we do that.
I would add to that, I don't know if I call it a secret sauce, but I think Ben will agree to this, that it's communication. You know, we went through the pandemic election and, you know, obviously none of us wanted to be in that situation whatsoever. We were happy with our elections in Kentucky, and that was not a situation we wanted to find ourselves in, but it is where we were. And we were in a situation where the one thing that we knew was elections have to work for Republicans and for Democrats. Can't work for just one. They have to work for both, because it's the only thing that kind of binds us together in this country, is that we all go vote the same way. Therefore, it has to work for everybody. And we couldn't fail. Failing was not an option. We had to do everything we could to try to preserve as much public confidence as we could possibly preserve, because it was a very difficult situation, uncharted territory for all of us. Ben will tell you that it wasn't always easy. We were in agreement by the time we got to a place where we were going to cast a vote. But does that mean that that's where we started? No, it's not where we started. Ben and I had some really lengthy, kind of tough conversations from time to time. I had tough conversations with the governor's office, but I was always very honest about where I was coming from, about what my point of view was. Ben was the same.
Democrat Ben Chandler, Republican Deanna Branger, members of the Kentucky Board of Elections. Thanks for joining us for Democracy Optimist, a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions and WEKU. Joshua Douglas, writer-host, Mike Savage, executive producer, I'm the series producer, Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer, Democracy Optimist theme song American by Madeline Peru, Mason Graver and Stephen Dabney, research assistants, Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at democracyoptimist.com, and podcast versions are available on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to get in touch? Our email is democracyoptimist@gmail.com. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Democracy Optimist from Eastern Standard and WEKU.